The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Now, for the hardened skeptic out there, unconventional flying objects and alien abductions are just too high on the strangeness scale to be accepted into their mindset. But even for the ufologists, those people who not only accept but study and investigate the phenomenon, there are cases that come up to come to their attention that are they file under the high strangeness category. It leaves them scratching their heads. And yet some of these cases involve physical and photographic evidence as well as multiple witness and who have nothing to gain by fabrication. Now, William Konkoleski is the state director for the Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON. And as such, he has been privy to several of these high strangeness cases. Bill has been interviewed on countless radio shows and TV documentaries to include Sci-Fi Channel's Abduction Diaries. He is the author of Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds. He has been the guest on this show before, and I'm proud to say a good friend of mine. So without further ado, welcome back to the show, Bill.
Thanks so much, Dave. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you back. yeah, you did a presentation at the last MUFON meeting about high strangeness cases. First of all, how long have you been the state director for Michigan MUFON?
It'll be 10 years now.
10 years. Wow, how time flies, eh?
10 years this month, exactly.
Wow. Yep. That's great. Congratulations on that. And you gave that presentation, and I got to step out of myself here, on high strangeness cases. Tell our listeners about the 1997 Pyramid in the Sky case.
Okay. This one was somebody who had phoned me up directly, and a gentleman called me, left a message about a very strange sighting he had. And as you find out, of course, it was a pyramid-shaped craft. And unfortunately, I had lost his phone number for a while. And when I eventually reached him back, I was impressed how all the details he had given me in his original call were exactly the same details he supplied to me several months later when I caught him off guard, calling him back. You know, I'm sure he didn't think I was going to call several months later. So when I got him on the phone, I'm like, okay, you had called earlier in the summer, and you had reported a UFO on my voicemail, and he's like, oh yeah, and then he went back through all the details of the sighting, which he called, it was probably 2 years ago, he phoned me, but the sighting was about something that happened back in 97.
Hmm.
In his sighting, It was the morning. It was about 8 a.m., he said, and he was traveling with his wife just south of Ann Arbor when he noticed a very bright sort of gleaming light in the sky. And he realized as he started to, him and his wife started to drive, they were driving north, and as they saw it come closer, they realized that the bright light was the sun hitting off something that was incredibly shiny in the sky. It appeared to be stationary, and when they got a little bit closer, they started to realize its size, which was massive.
Hmm.
They were driving north, coming closer to it. Some traffic was continuing to drive. Some traffic had pulled over to the side and was watching this thing. He described it as a pyramid, not a triangle here. We're not talking about a triangular-shaped craft, which is something pretty commonly reported, but an actual four-sided, you know, five if you count the bottom, pyramid flying in the sky. He said it had a very glossy finish to the four top sides of the pyramid, and at the bottom of the pyramid were two giant spotlights. The glossy four sides of the top of the pyramid, even more strangely, had hieroglyphics on them. Now, he said that these weren't your typical standard Egyptian hieroglyphics and that you could see like the eye of Horus or a bird or anything like that, but he said that the script on it was very much like hieroglyphics. He also said that the size was so massive of this object that it covered, hovering over the expressway, it covered both lanes of traffic, north and south. It was absolutely gigantic, he said, and absolutely stationary. So him and his wife pull over to the side of the road, and much like all the other people who had decided to stop, they're just standing slack-jaw, staring up at this thing. And then he said that it moved slightly, that the object gave just the slightest twist, and all heck broke loose. Everybody started to panic at that point. Was fine that it was up there hovering stationary, I guess, this giant flying pyramid. But when it started to move, that's when people really freaked out, started running, hopping in their cars, just getting the heck out of there.
Yeah.
Then it started to move more, and it started to spin. And it spun faster and faster, and it traveled southwards. And a moment later, as it was almost out of sight, two jet airplanes, fighter jets, came onto the scene in the direction of the object, and then the object shot straight up in the air and disappeared. One of the people that he had seen the object with, this woman who was a stranger at the time until they exchanged information, called him the following day and said that the people were reporting it to the local radio station. And in fact, later she even said that she was aware that the sheriff's department had even had a report of the objects from one of their officers themselves. He had filled out a report about the triangle, the pyramid, I should say, itself. So I asked him if I could receive a copy of that. I'm still waiting to receive it, but he says he doesn't have a copy of it, but his friend does. He knows it exists, and so I'm looking very much forward to actually having that police document of this very wild, crazy sighting in the sky.
When did you request this document?
From him at the time, which would have been initially maybe about a year and a half ago, and I touched back with him a couple times since then. I don't have a reliable way to get around him at the information that I'm aware, but
right. Yeah,
I'm definitely going to do my best to try to get a hold of that. I'm very excited to see it.
I wonder if you're being stonewalled on this, you know?
What way?
Well, in other words, you ask for information. I mean, I don't have to tell you as an investigator. You go to the authorities who you know have reports on it, and you say, you know, I'd like to get a copy of that. And it just kind of falls through the cracks, and a year later they say, oh, we don't know anything about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't expect much traction if I was to take the direct route. I'm not being cowardly, just accurately jaded, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Or,
you know, I just understand that the easiest way to get at the information is hopefully through the witness. If that's not available and I get desperate, you know, I'm knocking on the front door of the sheriff's department asking about some UFO sighting that's now almost 20 years old.
Yeah, right.
And see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So, boy, so there was multiple witnesses involved. And, you know, these pyramid-shaped, although they're very rare, they have been seen all over the world. And you speak about the symbols that resemble hieroglyphics. And you think back to ancient Egypt and how there's this debate as to whether the Egyptians actually made the pyramids, or were they made by ancient aliens, or did humans have help, etc., etc., etc. Do you think it's possible that ancient Egyptians made these pyramids in the shape of the gods that came down from the sky? Their craft?
If what this gentleman said he saw in 97 is accurate, one wonders why the craft was this particular shape and why the script on it was so similar to what we know historically as what people had seen, you know, thousands of years ago in terms of writing.
Mm.
You know, you can't take it off the table. One issue that I think that has been kind of a ball and chain around the ankles of paranormal and UFO research in recent decades is the UFO community has basically boxed itself in with regards to what they study and with regards to phenomena. You know, it's a craft, it's a gray alien, you know, that sort of a thing.
Mm.
They don't take in the Bigfoot sightings or the ghost sightings that that same witness who may have seen the UFO may have reported. The Bigfoot people had been focusing on their Bigfoot sightings, ignoring the a possible UFO tie-in. And et cetera, when it seems like there is a high degree of this sort of paranormal overlap. So I think that if one was to dismiss out of hand the possibility that these entities may have been around us for millennia and influencing our culture along the way, you know, you really have to examine as much evidence as you can and try to come up with some, you know, possibilities that you think might be correct, and keep an extremely open mind all the way.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah,
because, you know, there was this these cargo cults in New Guinea and islands off of New Guinea, where the natives see these. This is years ago, right after the war, during the war, or the Second World War. These biplanes would touch down, and they would revere them as gods because they'd never seen such a bird with a human being in it. And they would fashion out of mud and sticks and stones, they would fashion the likeness of that airplane and worship it. And there are many cultures that talk about the Vimanas in India and that type of thing. And they fashion their temples after these Vimanas, they're called, or UFOs, that came down from the sky. I'm just wondering about these pyramids and the connection it might have to ancient Egypt.
One thing that amused me, I really, I'll admit, I haven't watched much of the Ancient Aliens program, but one of the episodes I saw, the people on the show, they had taken this little metal artifact, maybe even gold, I forget, that looked like an airplane out of a museum, something that they knew to be thousands of years old,
right?
And they used the exact dimensions of it. They basically built the thing up into a remote control airplane,
right.
And it actually flew. It had a really solid flying design.
Right.
And I thought that was You know, it's more than it looks like something that could fly or an airplane. You turn it into an airplane and it actually flies. The shape is really solid for an aircraft.
Mm-hmm. So you think it's possible that a few thousand years ago they actually had manned flight or what?
Well, I would suspect that the probability would be that whoever was visiting us had that ability.
Right.
And it oppressed the people back then much in the way the cargo cults did.
Right. Right. And you see these writings etched into stone walls all over the world of disc-shaped craft coming down from the sky and humanoid beings that look pretty much like the big black-eyed grays that abductees or experiencers refer to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So it just, you know, just makes you wonder, right? So I'm going to take just a brief moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves here at Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Bill Konkoleski, the state director for the Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON. And we're talking about high strangeness cases. And there was also a high strangeness case that you mentioned, a 2012 case in Kansas City involving shape-shifting pyramids, now that we're on the subject of pyramids. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the odd synchronicity of it was, it was right shortly after, very shortly after, I had that call from the gentleman reporting the pyramid-shaped UFO that I went looking for other pyramid-shaped UFOs in our UFO database for MUFON, and I was really coming up empty-handed.
Mm.
And then right at that moment, just very shortly after in Kansas City, there was a young couple that actually reported seeing what seemed to be a very similar object. They didn't get quite as close to it as the witnesses here in Michigan. The craft that they saw was a little bit off on the horizon. The pyramid appeared black to them, but a very clear pyramid shape, and it had a haze around it, and they watched it approach them silently through the air, and when it got to a certain point, it changed from a pyramid and into sort of like a cigar shape. It flattened out and turned oblong right before their eyes and then disappeared over the trees. The two young witnesses, a young man and a young woman at the time they were dating, were really freaked out by this. They were in, I believe, her backyard, and they hopped in a car to try to chase after it, and they didn't see it anymore after they got on the road. Right after it changed shape, it disappeared. So it's not enough that there's pyramids flying in the sky, but they've either got hieroglyphics on them, or they turn into other shapes and fly away. You know, it's always... if you thought this was strange, wait, you haven't heard anything yet.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it just keeps getting stranger, as I found out as a MUFON investigator. When you say it flattened out, did it become like a square or a flat object? Do you know?
I had mentioned cigar-shaped. It was kind of oval.
Okay. Oh, you say it flattened out to an oval shape.
Correct, yeah.
Oh, okay. The reason I'm asking is some people report seeing at a distance a disc-shaped object with dome on the top, and then they'll say that it changed into a cigar-shaped object. Well, if you're looking at a disc-shaped object, imagine your typical UFO, disc-shaped UFO, and it's at a distance, you just turn that a little bit, and it'll appear like it's cigar-shaped. you know, it's got that dome. So, you know, or flat or whatever. And then if it turns again, well, it looks like a circle, you know, mm-hmm. because you're looking at the bottom or you're looking at the top. So that could account for some of these sightings that, you know, appear to be shapeshifters. They're really just one disc-shaped object. But not so much in the case of this pyramid. I can't see how the pyramid would turn into a cigar shape, mm-hmm. no matter how you turn it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well.
There was, in Ingo Swann's book, just to keep the pyramid train rolling, he had his book, Penetration, which is very difficult to find. He had said back in the 1970s, Ingo Swann being, of course, the great remote viewing pioneer,
mm-hmm.
he had been contacted by a sort of a secret, probably black budget organization to help them remote view unusual objects, unusual things. And they took him on a road trip one day. Road trip as an understatement, mm-hmm. and they drove him from California to the airport, flew him up to Alaska and out to the wild of Alaska, and brought him to the edge of this lake. And they appeared to have known, this secret group, that the secret government group seemed to have known that a UFO was going to appear over this lake out in the middle of these woods one night. And sure enough, this UFO starts to appear right before dawn, and it's pyramid-shaped.
Hmm.
And they tried to be as quiet and as hidden as possible, but the object seemed to have become aware that they were there and started shooting like lasers, something like that, at them, and so they hightailed it out of there.
Shooting
and
lasers.
When they got on their trip back, the agents asked Swan, so, you know, what did you think? What did you get out of that? And to which he had some kind of reply like, you know, this is not really how remote viewing works. More like ringside viewing.
Yeah. If it's all the same to you, sir, I will sit in my comfortable office over in New York or something and view all this stuff. I don't want to be out in the field getting shot at with lasers.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Wow. So so in this case, it was a pyramid-shaped object as well, eh?
Right. I'm deeply fascinated in pyramid-shaped objects now, and a very small number of cases seem to pop up where this tends to be the case. But if you get enough of these together from witnesses who have no idea of other people's reports, obviously, you know, just the volume of these things, that they creep up as you're able to identify more of them, lends to the collective credibility of the witnesses that they start to report things that are very similar to one another.
Right.
So that's definitely what I'm looking for now.
Yeah, and you'll find that, I don't have to tell you, but I'm telling our listeners, we investigators find that people who see something like a pyramid flying in the sky say, I'm not going to report that. People are going to think I'm crazy. Not realizing that other people all over the world have seen the same thing. And the more people who come forward, the more people will come forward with the same sighting. Am I right, Bill?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So.
And it's tough enough to get the word out about some of the types of sightings that we have that we hear about all the time. But triangle-shaped craft have really been around. People have been seeing them for a long time. A former Illinois state director of MUFON, David Marler, has an encyclopedic volume of pyramid sightings that go back hundreds of years. And it wasn't until, I think, it started to get out a little bit more in recent times that people said, oh, yeah, okay, I did see a pyramid-shaped craft. Where Traditionally, you would think that a UFO meant a disc-shaped object.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, definitely UFOs come in many shapes and sizes, which makes only deepens the mystery. And when people started really reporting their triangle sightings, we started to get more and more triangle sightings. And now I would say, you know, the triangle sightings are possibly quite on par with the number of disc sightings that we receive.
Right.
I don't know if I call it a pure 50-50, but it's definitely comparable.
Right. And the skeptic's going to say, well, one person hears about this different shaped object and they just copycat it. But in fact, what's going on is the second person feels a little more comfortable with reporting what he or she saw because of the first report. And then the floodgates open, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so. So anything more on pyramid-shaped UFOs?
No, but if anybody wants to get in touch with me or connect with you through the station, if they had a pyramid sighting or aware of anybody who had one, I'd definitely like to hear from you.
Yeah. And where do they go on the web to check out MUFON?
Our state chapter, I'll start with that, is for Michigan MUFON, which is mymufon.org, M-I for Michigan, M-U-F-O-N.org.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's M-I-M-U-F-O-N.org. For the international site, if you want to put a sighting report directly into the international site, you can go to MUFON.com.
Very good. Yeah, we need all the reports we can get. I mean, you know, it's... Yeah, we'd like to get bogged down with reports if possible, because the more we get into the database, the better we become informed and the better we can inform the public. Am I right?
Well, absolutely. And if I could just interject that,
mm-hmm.
Last year, Michigan, just to give you know, the audience members some sort of picture of how many we received, how many sighting reports, in 2013... just Michigan MUFON received 315 UFO sighting reports. And these are reports directly to us from firsthand witnesses. Now, if you think that's a lot, 2012 we actually had 422 sighting reports.
Hmm.
So in just the last 2 years, you know, we're talking about over 700 sighting reports to us. So people are seeing UFOs everywhere. They're seeing them all the time. They're seeing a lot of them. This isn't just some small thing where, you know, maybe we'll get a handful, like a dozen sightings a year. No, this is high volume we're talking about.
Yeah. Of course, not all of those are extraterrestrial in origin. What percentage would you say are misidentifications or even hoaxes?
Well, with regards to the sightings we get in, I would say what you normally hear is that something like 5% of what people see are really anomalous. And I do agree that it is just a very small percentage of what people see are anomalous.
Mm.
I would say that what MUFON tends to receive is probably about 20% of the sightings that we get in are anomalous. The reason for the big jump from, say, like 5% to 20% is that I think people self-edit, as one way to put it. They will reason away the sighting before they get to the point where they contact us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if a person sees something in the sky, of course, first of all, they have to notice it. They have to think it's unusual. They have to want to tell somebody. They have to want to tell somebody besides just their inner circle of friends and family member. Then they actually have to find a group like MUFON and then do the work to actually fill out a sighting report.
Mm-hmm.
By the time somebody gets to that point, they are going to be pretty serious that their sighting was unusual to, you know, make it through all those steps and actually get in their sighting report to us. So I think that's why we see a bigger percentage of anomalous sightings within our database than what you would find in the normal average of what somebody sees in the sky and just thinks is anomalous and isn't necessarily anomalous.
Right. And even if an individual thinks it might just be a plane or something like that, if there's anything to indicate the color of lighting, I always say, if you see a blue light on that quote-unquote plane, it's not a plane, right? Mm-hmm. So don't try to talk yourself out of it, out of reporting it, because, you know, if it was a plane, don't feel embarrassed when we analyze it and find out that it was a plane, because you have done your part in reporting something that you didn't understand, you couldn't identify. But see, one day you will see something truly anomalous, and then you'll be afraid to report it. We don't want that to happen. Is that right, Bill?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even if it's what we've been seeing in recent years, one of the big reasons I think we've seen a spike in sightings, which we definitely have over the past couple few years, is that people have been seeing what are known as Chinese lanterns in the sky,
right,
and reporting them as UFOs.
Right.
Chinese lanterns are, you know, basically they're little mini hot air balloons. You could essentially stick a candle in a plastic bag and send it off, and it'll fly. And if you can send off a whole bunch of them at the same time, you know, it looks a lot more impressive even. And so these Chinese lanterns are available all over the place. You can get them at fireworks stores. You can get them. Somebody said they even saw them at a furniture store.
Furniture store.
Yeah, drug stores, toy stores. These are all the places I heard that carry these things. And people fly them at funerals. People fly them at weddings. People fly them for the heck of it. So if you see in the sky what appears to be a little flicker of flame flying overhead, moving at a fairly steady pace, pretty slowly in the sky, possibly several of these things, what you're seeing could very well be a Chinese lantern.
Yeah.
A lot of people who aren't familiar with these and all of a sudden see flames, you know, drifting through the sky, that's definitely something that would catch your attention, but they're pretty cheap. Somebody said that they saw them somewhere for $2 a piece or something like that, so very easy to get a bunch of these things and let them go.
Yeah. At the same time, I've seen reports, and I start to read these reports, and yeah, these are five or six orange lights flickering in the sky, moving along at a steady pace, and I'm saying to myself, Chinese lantern, Chinese lantern. And then all of a sudden, zip, they all zipped off straight up and out of sight. I said, whoop, not a Chinese lantern.
Yeah, so yeah, if you're not sure, like you say, definitely report it, and we'll try to sort out what we know of them with what it is that you saw and try to get to the bottom of it.
Right, that's right, that's right. There was also a case, tell us about the case where a man and his daughter are driving down a road and found themselves miles away, seemingly instantaneously. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. There was a time where I was, especially when the girl was still growing up, still in school, that I was fairly guarded about the identities of these individuals.
Okay.
But, I can come out pretty much straight and say that the witnesses in this case are my older brother and my niece.
Oh, okay.
So at the time, you know, they were fairly guarded, especially my niece was 14 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And but now that they're adults, they don't seem to care at all. My brother, if anybody has a copy of my book, Experiencer, this is my brother John in the book, and his daughter Rose. And it was the particular event that you're talking about, which doesn't actually appear in my book, happened back in 2004. It was late August, and the two of them were driving on my brother was driving, and it was a fairly familiar road for them, and it wasn't that they were someplace where they could have gotten confused or anything like that. It was they were coming out of Imlay City and down to Leonard, Michigan, if anybody's familiar with the area. And it was about 1 a.m. And so they're driving south, and it was Lake Pleasant Road. They were driving south on Lake Pleasant Road. And they were driving, just talking about my niece's upcoming school year. Suddenly, the road in front of them fogged. Like, they just hit this sudden patch of fog. And then when the fog dissipated, which was pretty much immediately, my brother said it didn't, it wasn't as if they drove through a fog. He said the fog actually pixelated away. If you can sort of picture what I mean there in terms of, like, if you ever saw like a PowerPoint presentation where it's got this, where the transition from one slide to another breaks up the picture into a lot of little tiny dots and then it comes back into focus again.
All right.
So he said that the road in front of them, the fog disappeared in a pixelated way, and suddenly they were no longer on Lake Pleasant Road. They didn't know what road they were on. My brother checked the compass, and instead of driving south as they had been, now they were suddenly driving west. They were on a fairly rural road the first time, and this time also on a fairly rural road. One big difference is that when they got out of the fog and looked around, they were surrounded by all sorts of forest animals. We're talking like something out of like Snow White. Deer, there were rabbits, skunks, raccoons. My brother said there was just a virtual zoo of animals around them when the fog broke. And then when they drove a little bit down the road, the animals were gone. And so they kept driving west, and then until they, you know, both of them were scared pretty well, obviously. And so they didn't want to stop the car. They didn't want to do anything but keep driving until they hopefully found a patch of road that they were familiar with. And then eventually they did get to a road they recognized, only to find out that they were now about 6 miles northeast where they had been just a moment before. They suddenly, in the blink of an eye, and my brother looked at the clock. He had checked the clock shortly before they disappeared, like a couple minutes, and checked the clock immediately afterwards, and he said that there appeared to be no breakage of time. There was no song on the radio at the time. The radio was off, so they couldn't tell if, you know, if the song had jumped or anything like that.
Right.
But he said it was as if they had instantly jumped from one place to another. He stayed up all night. She stayed up till like about 4 a.m., and he stayed up till about 9 a.m. They both had some light nausea afterwards. And then both of them slept a good chunk of the next day, and neither of them could figure it out. And both of them now, it's been 10 years, both of them still stick to the same exact details. And me knowing both of them quite well, obviously, I take them to be highly credible witnesses.
Yeah. How did your niece take this? Was she highly upset about it for a while? I mean, she was 14, the poor kid, you know?
Yep, she was very scared. She was very upset. My brother had a sort of a history of paranormal things happening to him, but it wasn't one of those generational things that had passed down to his daughter. So his daughter was aware that he had had some unusual encounters in life, ghost sightings, out of body, stuff like that, that he had had in the past, but she'd never encountered any of it directly. And then suddenly, blammo, she's with him when one of these events happens. And then you start to think, you know, she started to think, well, maybe my dad isn't as crazy as I thought he was after all.
Thanks a lot, Dad, for dragging me into this stuff, huh?
Yep, I blame you. I haven't raised my allowance. It's interesting too is that I at the time I was not aware of this being anything that anybody reported. To me, this was a fairly unique event. I didn't doubt that it may have very well happened to other people, but interestingly enough, just last year, 2013, Kathleen Martin, who I know you've had on the show, she put out her book, Abduction Files.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, one of the her co-author, actually, Denise Stoner, talks about just that very same thing. Her and her husband were driving down in Florida on the way to go scuba diving, and suddenly they hit a fog in the road and found themselves somewhere else.
Well, same thing then, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, so how are they doing today? How's Rose doing today?
Oh, great. I'm going to Oakland University, doing quite well.
Great. And nothing like that's happened to her again?
Not that I'm aware.
Not that she's going to tell you about, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. I got to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves here at Henry Ford Community College. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with the state director of the Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, Mr. Bill Konkoleski. And he's also the author of Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds. And take a minute and tell us about that book of yours, Bill, Experiencer.
Yeah, my book, Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds, is about roughly about the first 20 years of my life. My very first memory in life from age 2 is seeing a little gray guy come into my bedroom. And this was not a memory that came back to me years later, but a memory that was burned into me the moment it happened, and I never forgot.
Hmm.
At age 4, I had another experience that I was able to recall. Age 7, 9, 10, several experiences in my teens. And while my intention is to eventually get out other experiences that I had later in life into other books, that first book, Experience of Raised in Two Worlds, is out there to show what it's like to be a child growing up with an ongoing abduction regimen. it's to show, you know, a lot of times the abduction phenomena, when it touches on children, is seen through the adult's eyes and trying to sympathize with children, trying to comfort children. But I wanted to put out sort of a journal of what it's like to be a child going through these experiences, what I remembered of these experiences, how I felt about these experiences as I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, if there are parents who unfortunately are dealing with children who are going through this type of thing, that my book would be helpful to them in understanding what it is, how their children feel as they're going through these horrible experiences. Well, sometimes not horrible, but too often, you know, as a child, you get desperately confused about what's going on.
Right.
The whole world tells you that what you're going through isn't real, but yet you know it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you try to convince the grown-up world that something really anomalous is going on in your life, and often they're comforting, or, you know, but, you know, they don't tend to believe children very much.
No, it's just their imagination, and sometimes it is, but sometimes it is not, and perhaps your book, Experiencer, Raised in Two Worlds, would help parents make that distinction between who's the imaginary friend and who is a real being, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's good. And getting back to our high strangeness cases, you mentioned a 1964 case in Cisco Grove. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if you are familiar with Ruben Uriarte out of California. He's one of the California regional directors out of there. He had actually done on behalf of MUFON, the direct investigation of this case. And so if you ever get a chance to get him on your show, he's definitely a good one to tell the story.
Yeah.
The actual witness, unfortunately, has now passed away. And Ruben actually put out a book on it. I'm trying to think of the name of the book. But if you look up Cisco Grove, I think on Amazon, I think that's part of the title of the book he eventually put out about it.
Cisco spells C-I-S-C-O.
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Now, this witness had actually been well, his case had actually been well investigated over the years. It's kind of funny, any UFO organization, that's anybody, had at one point gotten his story and done their own investigation of it. You know, NICAP did an investigation, APRO did an investigation, all the old UFO groups that are no longer with us, and MUFON did its own investigation. So this case had been investigated many times over, and the witness never changed his story. And so at this point, you know, he's no longer with us, but his story has been well documented. And essentially, the story, he was, this again was back in 64, him and a couple buddies decided in California to go to the Cisco Grove campground, and that's in Tahoe National Forest. And the guy, the witness, Donald Trump, him and his two friends, while they decided to go camping and bow hunting in the forest, he got separated from his friends on the first day. In fact, they had intentionally split up to cover more ground while they were bow hunting. And he, when he got to a certain point, that he decided that he had better come back to the camp, otherwise it was going to be too dark to easily find his way to the camp. He took a wrong turn on his return trip and got a little bit lost. When he realized he was not going to be able to make it back to the campground, he decided that he would just stay out in the woods all night. He wasn't aware of what kind of predators might be out there hunting at night, so he didn't want to get lost, even more lost than he already was, and then end up as some bear's lunch or some, or night, I should say.
Really?
Or whatever. So what he did was he climbed up a tree. And while he was, he had heard that that was an effective way to not be surprised by some of the predators that would come after him. So he was up and sitting high in his tree when off in the distance he saw some light. And he interpreted that as a search helicopter looking for him. So he went, he climbed down out of the tree and lit a fire to attract the helicopter, what he thought was a helicopter. And this light came silently drifting towards him, and he's like, well, that's strange. This helicopter's not making any noise. So the object got to quite close to him, and he sees that it's about 150 feet long. It's a giant black silent cigar shape, and it's got three portholes on the side. And so obviously he got scared. He shimmies back up the tree, and while he's watching this thing hidden in the tree, out of the side of it comes this smaller object, like a disc-shaped object, which lands in the woods, maybe about a mile or half mile, I think he said, from where he was actually up in the tree. While he's waiting there, watching this giant flying thing in the sky, wondering what that thing was that came out of the side of it and went to the woods, there came out of the woods a group of guys that looked like essentially your typical grays. They were in these white coverall outfits, and they're walking around in the woods right beneath him. And he said that they didn't seem to actually care that he was up in the tree. They just went about doing their things. There were five of them, and they went around like looking at rocks, picking flowers, things like that. And he's like, do they really not know I'm here? Because I think it's the fire that attracted him, you know, he's thinking. And then all of a sudden, two of them look up at him in the tree, and they're just kind of staring up at him. And then just go back to doing whatever it was that they were doing, completely ignoring them. And then this what reports to be a robot walks out of the woods. This sort of armored man with glowing red eyes stomps up to the tree that he's in. And he's really scared now, obviously, because these little guys that were walking around the woods right below him, they didn't seem to care too much about him. So only maybe 9.9 on the scary scale. But then this giant robot comes out, or it was a man-shaped robot, and when it comes under the tree where he's at, it opens its mouth. It has a mouth, and this vapor comes out of it. And as his vapor climbs up the tree and gets to him, he passes out just for a moment, and then he wakes up again. Luckily, he had his bow across a couple of the branches, so when he got knocked out, he fell on his bow and then woke up again. And the thing repeatedly kept shooting his vapor out of its mouth, and he repeatedly kept going unconscious and waking up again. And so he decided he was going to fight back at it. He started shooting arrows at the thing, he managed to hit the thing with all three of the arrows that he had with him still, and all the arrows ricocheted off of him.
Hmm.
So he didn't know what to do next, so he had some matches, he started to light things on fire. He would light a branch on fire, throw it down, he ran out of easy branches to break off and light on fire. So he lit his hat on fire. He started to light money on fire and throw it down at the robot and these other little guys that were around in the area. And it did seem to spook them. It did seem to bother the creatures around the tree so that they did back off.
Mm.
But the little alien guys and the robot decided to up the ante, and a second robot comes out. And so now there are two robots that were under the tree. And he knew he was really in for it this time, so he took his belt and actually strapped himself to the tree. And the two beings this time, after shooting lightning, apparently, between them, their own bodies, yes, this is getting stranger by the moment.
Really?
Both of these robots start emitting that gas of the tree, and once again, he keeps passing out and waking up again. And after they had done this so many times, when he passed out and woke up, it was suddenly daytime, and they were gone. The robots were gone. The little gray guys were gone. The UFO was gone. He was just up there tied to the tree.
Hmm.
So he made his way out of the tree, stumbled back to where he thought the camp was. One of his hunting buddies came and found him and brought him home. And there was a follow-up of sorts to this, and that he decided that he was going to report this to the Air Force. The Air Force took his report, seemed to laugh off what he was saying, even suggesting that it was teenagers that were poking fun at him, playing a joke on him, what he'd seen. And when he said, these obviously weren't any teenagers, one of the Air Force guys says, there are still some Japanese who are upset about World War II. Maybe that's what you maybe that's what you saw. So, just totally making fun of this guy.
This was in 64, right?
Yep. Yeah, so the war was kind of over, I think, by then, if I get my history correct. Yeah,
20 years.
So he went back, after he had reported his sighting to the Air Force, he went back to the actual site where the event happened, and he noticed that the area was visibly picked clean of anything that was there. He would have expected to see half-burned items that he had thrown out of the tree, things like that, but he said that the ground, in fact, around that particular tree was combed, like somebody took a rake and made sure they got every possible little piece of evidence out of it.
Hmm.
So he thinks that after the Air Force laughed him off, they went and did their own investigation and scooped up any evidence they could.
Right.
He also was able to retrieve all of the arrows that he shot at the robot, and he gave one of the arrows to the Air Force, which they conveniently lost right away.
Certainly.
And then he himself lost the other two arrows.
Nice.
So, yeah, he unfortunately passed away just a couple of years ago, so he's no longer with us. But, for a full and more in-depth account, Ruben Uriarte's book, No Torres, I believe is the name of his co-author on that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is on Amazon.
So there's actually a full book on the Cisco Grove incident, eh?
Yeah, and if you're letting your imagination run wild with what you think these beings look like, I suggest pick up the book because it's got a lot of the illustrations of these beings, and I can pretty much guarantee you these things looked as strange as your imagination is probably picturing them. The robot and these old ray guys, the UFO, the whole shot.
Yeah.
Very creepy, very weird.
Well, the biological entities are strange enough to accept for the open-minded skeptic, and the closed-minded skeptic is going to say, Stanton Friedman says, my mind's made up, don't confuse me with the facts. but then when you throw the robot in, it does get a little bit of the high strangeness factor. At the same time, that's not the only case that involved what appeared to be robot or mechanical beings. So
the Flatwoods Monster.
Flatwoods Monster, yeah.
If that's what you're thinking about, yeah.
Yeah.
So, that case in the 50s where several people saw what appeared to be a robot that, to me, when I look at the shape of the robot, it reminds me of a chess piece, like maybe the queen or the king.
Right.
In terms of its shape, it had a long skirt and a truncated top with a dome head. Like the people who back in the 50s had seen the Flatwoods Monster, this robot that they had seen out of a glowing red UFO, that particular robot emitted a noxious gas as well.
Right. Right. So you just don't know. Sometimes these stories do coincide with each other. And as strange as it might be, well, now you've got two people more than two people telling the same story. And like I say, the more who come forward, the more who will come forward. So I appreciate you sharing these thoughts, sharing these cases with us today. And tell us once more where people can check out your work and also Michigan MUFON.
Okay. For my personal website, that is experiencer.me, .me. That gives a bit of a background, personal background for myself, and talks about things that I cover in the book. And I have a blog, which I contribute to on a monthly basis, just my thoughts at the moment about the abduction phenomena. And if you are looking and interested to become a MUFON member or to find out about our next MUFON meeting, Michigan MUFON's website is MIMUFON.org. And also our international website is MUFON.com. If you go to our international website, they have a really nifty tool where you can search our UFO database of all the sightings that have been reported.
Sounds good. Bill Konkoleski, thank you so much again for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again soon. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then the Tuesday Forum, and, of course, the date of the show. And We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is UFOImplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.fm, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.